Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. So happy Wednesday. The latest infrastructure deal fell apart. I'm guessing that another one is on the way, or at least they will pretend that one is on the way. This does feel like we're in infrastructure week forever. It is sort of like Groundhog Day. The massive IRS leak makes for a good story, although people kind of wonder how much information, what this breach of the IRS privacy laws, what it actually means. The former guy down in Mar-a-Lago is cheerleading for cancel culture, literally. The idiocracy is spreading around the country. That's separate. In Congress, I would argue whiffs on January 6th. And meanwhile, we actually had real elections. We had primaries in New Jersey and Virginia. We had a lot of things actually going on. So we are pleased to be joined by Jeffrey Skelly of 538. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it very much.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
We want you down because we wanted you on because we want to break down these numbers, what happened in Virginia, what happened in New Jersey. You have a really interesting piece about polling about what Americans think about bipartisanship, what they mean by bipartisanship. And I'm sure that because you guys at 538 are really like serious deep thinkers, that you didn't want to come on a podcast just to make fun of stupid people, right?
I mean, look, everybody enjoys doing that a little bit.
But, okay, so I have some bad – because if that was the case, I had some bad news for you. So we have to – I'm sorry. I don't mean to start every single day this way, you know, but I – you know, yesterday we started off with Charlie Kirk talking about how there were 15, you know, nations in the world in 1945. I'm guessing he meant the members of the United Nations, but whatever. Did you happen to catch – the Louis Gohmert question that he asked during a hearing. Okay, now, I understand that this is low-hanging fruit. Louis Gohmert is notoriously the stupidest member of the U.S. Congress. And this is during a – this is one of those virtual hearings on climate change. And I kid you not, this actually happened. This is Republican Congressman Louis Gohmert.
And I understand from what's been testified to the Forest Service and the BLM, you want very much to work on the issue of climate change. I was informed by the immediate past director of NASA that they have found that the moon's orbit is changing slightly, and so is the Earth's orbit around the sun. We know there's been significant solar flare activity. And so is there anything that the National Forest Service or BLM can do to change the course of the moon's orbit or the Earth's orbit around the sun? Obviously, that would have profound effects on our climate.
It would. It would. Just asking questions there. Now, that there is some speculation that I see on the internets that perhaps this was Louis Gohmert's very, very dry humor. This speculation is being pushed by people who've never actually met or listened to Louis Gohmert. So, Jeffrey, this would actually affect the climate, though, wouldn't it, if we could do this?
Well, I think the main thing I'm struggling with is how exactly you'd go about doing that.
Yeah, I know.
You know, if he is serious, what sort of incredible undertaking would have to happen, you know, some sort of like large explosion of some kind, some sort of wind sail for the entire planet or just the moon. I mean, I'm just like
the wind sail. That's a good idea. You know,
or I guess it would be like a solar wind sail to be more precise.
Could the UFOs help us with this? Now that we're talking about UFOs, is there somehow, can we connect the dots with the UFOs? You know, and of course, remember we, until very recently, had a president of the United States who speculated about the possibility of using nuclear bombs to deal with hurricanes. So again, we're just asking questions. We need to be bipartisan today. I understand we need to be bipartisan because this did remind me, Louis Gohmert's a Republican. This reminded me of Georgia Democrat Hank Johnson's trenchant question a few years back. Remember Congressman Hank Johnson? Let's play the question that he asked an admiral of the Navy who was testifying before his committee.
Yeah, my fear is that the whole island will become so overly populated that it will tip over and capsize?
We don't anticipate that.
He's, of course, referring to Guam. So, Jeff, have you ever been to Guam?
You know, I've not been to Guam.
No. But have you ever worried about whether or not Guam would be so overpopulated that it would tip over? Do you ever worry about that, that we could have an island, like, you know, a whole island actually tip over if you put too much stuff on it?
No, that is not a concern I've ever had. And I enjoy the fact that the Admiral started out by sort of saying, that's not a problem we've anticipated. A very polite answer. Yeah.
Yes, we'll get back to you on that, Congressman. We really seriously do not anticipate that Guam will tip over. Okay, so just one more. In the state of Ohio, they had a legislative hearing on the questions of vaccinations and whether or not vaccination should be required or whether we should ban the requirement of vaccinations, whatever. It's really kind of not the point. And one of the people who was testifying had this observation about vaccines. This actually happened in the Ohio legislature.
Now we're all kind of hypothesizing. I mean, what is it that's actually being transmitted that's causing all of these things? Is it a combination of the protein, which now we're finding has a metal attached to it? I'm sure you've seen the pictures all over the internet of people who've had these shots and now they're magnetized. They can put a key on their forehead, it sticks. They can put spoons and forks all over them and they can stick because now we think that there's a metal piece to that. There's been people who've long suspected that there was some sort of an interface, yet to be defined, an interface between what's being injected in these shots and all of the 5G towers. Not proven yet.
No.
But we're trying to figure out what is it that's being transmitted to these unvaccinated people.
This is actually worse than it sounds because this woman who is testifying before the Ohio legislature is a woman named Sherry Tenpenny, who is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. She's an osteopath, a big anti-vax activist, has written 4 books opposing vaccination and has been the go-to anti-vax spokesperson for Josh Mandel, who is a Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate. So this is not just some random woman that showed up at the hearing. This is somebody who has been touted by one of the leading candidates for the United States Senate, Josh Mandel. Her name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and you cannot make this up. I'm actually sitting here trying to do this. I'm trying to put my keys on my forehead, and they're not sticking, Jeffrey. So I don't know if that constitute evidence.
Me neither. As a vaccinated person, I'm not having that problem. And, you know, this is the sort of thing that, you know, I've become very interested in QAnon, the QAnon conspiracy over the last year or so. Basically, ever since Marjorie Taylor Greene entered the political realm, I was like, I really need to learn about this now. And this sort of these kinds of statements and beliefs really just come out of that sort of thing. It's kind of incredible. It's also very depressing.
Well, but she saw it on the internet. I mean, she saw it on YouTube. I mean, this is a real thing. And again, I don't know. I kind of have a joke with some of my When I used to do a radio talk show and people would call up about various things, the phrase, I've done my research, Charlie, I've done my research, was always followed by some batshit crazy conspiracy theory. I don't know what it was about that particular phrase. People see something on YouTube and they go, okay, this is what's going on. This is the real, this is the secret truth. See, I guess part of, you know, I'm playing this, you know, we played Louis Gohmert and we played Hank Johnson and then this, the woman from Ohio and, just, you know, number one, don't try this at home, putting, you know, keys on your forehead or, you know, hoping that you're going to be able to, you know, save your keys that way. But there's nothing that prevents this woman from running for and being elected to Congress. She could be 2 years from now. She could be a member of Congress. She could be a committee chairman the way things are going right now. Because the fact that she believes those things is not disqualifying for much of the electorate, as you have noted. Jeffrey.
Right.
Jeffrey's thinking, I have to actually answer these questions. I have to talk about this.
No.
What did my PR people get me into?
No, it's something that, I mean, essentially it's interesting because in the past, political parties had maybe a little bit more of a filtering process for candidates. You know, major leaders could encourage someone to run or discourage someone to run. And, you know, there's not really that process anymore. You know, people can just sort of run. And if they are popular enough, or if they, you know, are talented enough at gaining support, they can win, even if they do happen to hold detached views or something.
Well, I actually am leading up to a serious question, believe it or not. So we also have this new Politico Morning Consult poll out that asks people about this fantasy that Donald Trump will be reinstated as president in August. And according to this poll, they find 29% of Republicans, nearly one out of three Republicans, who think that, yes, it is possible that Donald Trump will be reinstated. They believe he will be reinstated in August, which raises the question, Jeffrey. And I guess because we get these crazy numbers, you know, 53% of Republicans think that Trump is a legitimate president. You study polls and public opinion all the time. This is actually a serious question. How much of this is real, and how much of this is just people answering the pollster questions, sort of signaling their identity, just throwing the shit up against the wall? I mean, you know what I'm saying here? I mean, how much does this reflect actual belief as opposed to just people striking an attitude and maybe even trolling the pollsters? What do you think?
Right. I mean, that's actually a very difficult question to know for sure. You know, 29%, you know, it's quite possible that a significant share of that 29% truly does believe that. There's certainly a conspiracy theory out there that's being pushed. You saw it at like the, I think it was being called the QCon, like the QAnon conference last weekend or the weekend before, where there's a strain of thought out there that this is going to happen, that Trump will be reinstated. So I'm sure that a significant percentage of that 29% do actually believe that, but some of it may also be wishful thinking. It may be, as you said, you know, sort of saying, well, I like Trump and I hope this is true, so I'm going to say, yeah, sure. It's difficult to say for sure, but I think when you see a number like 29% of Republicans, on the one hand, that's very far from a majority. So clearly not everyone is sort of buying into this ludicrous notion, but it also does signal that a not small share of people do actually believe this sort of thing. So that's sort of my general takeaway from it.
Okay, so let's flip around. So we actually had elections yesterday in New Jersey and in Virginia. In New Jersey, the headline on the Politico story is Trump backers lose big in the, you know, race for governor, GOP nomination in New Jersey. So tell me what you were watching in New Jersey and Virginia and what we now know, because we're a lot smarter because we actually have the results.
Sure. It always helps to have the actual numbers at the end of the day.
It almost feels like cheating, you know?
Well, you know, with the New Jersey race, you had sort of gradients of Trump support. You had the guy who won, Jack Chitarelli, former member of the state legislature in New Jersey, had run in 2017, had sort of a moderate profile when he was a member of the legislature. He's socially conservative on tax issues, and he did not like Trump. He actually called him a charlatan during the 2016 presidential primary. So maybe not the best position if Trump has become very popular in the Republican Party. So Chitarelli has become more supportive of Trump, more supportive of his policies as time has gone on. But he is not, for instance, in the lone debate in the New Jersey primary on the GOP side, he said Biden won the election. You know, Trump had a bunch of lawsuits. They got tossed out. The courts didn't find them, you know, didn't find evidence. And so Biden had won, whereas one of his opponents, the only one who made the debate, a guy named Hirsch Singh, who is basically an all-out Trump supporter, said, we all know that Trump won the election. Chitarelli is in some ways sort of more traditional Republican, but pro-Trump in terms of a number of policies. And then you had Singh and another candidate, Phil Rizzo. Rizzo actually finished second in the primary and Singh third, who were both much more vocally pro-Trump, asserted, you know, conspiracies and falsehoods about the election result, about fraud, Singh even in that debate called Chitterelli, a Cheney Romney Republican, the type who stabbed Trump in the back, roughly his quote. I'm paraphrasing. So you had that sort of dynamic, and I do find that headline interesting. At the end of the day, it looks like Chitterelli is going to win with about half the vote. He's at 49%, according to the New York Times, and I'm not sure how much is left out in terms of votes remaining to be counted. And the other two candidates who were notably pro-Trump added up to about 48%. Mm-hmm. Now, if it had been a head-to-head race between Chitterelli and one of those candidates, Chitterelli probably would have won. But nonetheless, I do think the fact that Rizzo and Singh got 48% of the vote, you do see a pretty significant, very firmly pro-Trump constituency there. Even in a blue state like New Jersey, the fact of the matter is Republicans anywhere are pretty pro-Trump at the end of the day.
They are, but at least the least woolly guy won that primary. Okay, so let's talk about Virginia. The Republicans didn't have a primary; they had a convention. But the former governor Terry McAuliffe won rather easily in the Democratic primary. Were you a little bit surprised by how easily he won the margin?
I think to some extent I was a little surprised by the margin. I think part of that just came down to the fact that the little polling that we did have put McAuliffe sort of close to 50%, clearly in the lead. I think everybody expected him to win fairly comfortably. But at the end of the day, it's like the undecideds did not end up mostly going to other candidates. A large chunk of them also went to McAuliffe. So that's how he got to 62% or so of the vote. So in terms of the sort of magnitude of his win, it might have been a little larger than I expected. Nonetheless, it was sort of obvious that he was going to win because opposition had not coalesced around one candidate. And I think that was a real challenge for the other, basically for anyone who opposed McAuliffe, was that there was no one candidate who sort of broke out from the rest of the field to become maybe a challenger from McAuliffe's left. And I think also another factor there is that, look, Virginia is a pretty establishment-friendly state on the Democratic side of the aisle. We saw Biden comfortably win it in the presidential primary. Hillary Clinton won it in 2016 rather easily. Ralph Northam won in a head-to-head race in 2017 against Tom Perriello in the Democratic primary, ended up winning by 11 or 12 points. So the state definitely, in every one of those cases, you're talking about sort of the more establishment-friendly candidate winning. And so McAuliffe winning in this way sort of fits into that. And you saw that down ballot, too, in Virginia, in that a state delegate, Hala Ayala, won the lieutenant governor's race. Now, that was a much more crowded affair, but she ended up winning, and perhaps by a lot more than I think anyone might have thought. She got 39%, but there were six active candidates in the race. So it was a crowded race. But then also Mark Herring, the incumbent attorney general, defeated Jay Jones. And so Herring's seeking his third term as attorney general. So I think the results reflect that pattern in Virginia politics. I mean, I think progressives have been making some progress in Virginia on the Democratic side of the aisle. But at the same time, it's still a state where sort of center left is the name of the game in the party as a whole.
Well, that was what I was going to ask you next, because once again we saw that the Democratic primary electorate did seem to be more centrist as opposed to progressive. The centrist did well yesterday, as opposed to the Democratic socialist types.
Yeah, in fact, actually, what's interesting is that Lee Carter, who ran for governor, he's a member of the House of Delegates, only got about 3% of the vote. He finished last in the 5-person field. But in Virginia, there's a quirk in the law that permits someone to also seek re-election to their seat in the state legislature while also seeking a statewide office. And Carter ended up losing his primary, in fact. And so he lost renomination for the House of Delegates. And that it's interesting because Carter is a Democratic Socialist. He's a member of the Democratic Socialists of America. His defeat, I think, will be taken in some circles as a sign of maybe that approach not working as well. I think there are other things that were also going on there. Carter's from a district that has a very large Hispanic population. Anyway, I think there's some local factors there that will also play into it.
All right, let's shift to Washington politics, because obviously you had a piece last week talking about bipartisanship and how people really feel about it, which, of course, is topic number one, given the number one, the announcement by Joe Manchin that he's not going to support the filibuster. Number two, the breakdown of the talks that had been going on about a bipartisan infrastructure package. So I guess the question is, everybody keeps talking about bipartisanship, and it comes back to the question I asked you about polls before. Is this one of those issues where everyone says they're in favor of bipartisanship, but nobody really cares that much? I mean, what is your sense? Because, I mean, is this one of those things that politicians feel they need to give lip service to? Or is it really important to voters out in the real world?
I sort of want to go halfway on this, or sort of straddle those two points. I think it's important. I mean, I think voters want politicians to give lip service to the idea of bipartisanship. And I think in theory, they like the idea. It's like, well, this would be great. But it's sort of like if you line up a policy outcome that they find favorable, that their party prefers, and you say, in actuality, would you prefer the bipartisan policy outcome or the more partisan outcome backed by your party? People are going to pick the one backed by your party every time, even though they say, I mean, that sounds right. Intuitive to people, but the fact of the matter is a lot of polls have shown people really, they say when asked that they like bipartisan outcomes, but if you actually test out their sentiments at the end of the day, they prefer those more partisan ones.
Yeah. It's when push comes to shove, the bipartisanship goes, right? I mean, it's like people are, you're on the diet, but if you put a, you know, a bowl of marshmallows in front of them, they can eat the marshmallows. The Biden administration is trying to redefine bipartisanship. I thought you had an interesting point about what the polls are showing about this, that the Biden folks are trying to say that something is bipartisan if Republican voters or a significant number of Republican voters favor it, whereas most people seem to think, no, bipartisanship means you have to have Republican votes. You have to have the votes of the other party in the legislature. Is that an important distinction? I mean, again, this is one of those things where I kind of wonder whether or not this is sort of the thing that people say, because that does seem to be, I don't know, it seems to get a little bit muddled. You know what I'm getting at here?
No, absolutely. Basically, what the Morning Consult Politico poll found was that if you asked voters which definition best matched their interpretation of the word bipartisan, only 10% said it involved getting broad support from just voters or Americans across the political spectrum. Many more said it had to involve – basically, the other two definitions – involved at least some support from lawmakers from the other party, or for both parties, I should say. And so most people picked an answer that involved lawmakers, either lawmakers and voters or just lawmakers from the other party. So I think the fact here is that more default bipartisan definition for Americans is something involving lawmakers from the other party supporting some legislation.
So give me your sense of how important it is for Joe Biden to continue to at least look like he's doing this, because he's under tremendous pressure from his own party to say, look, screw it. McConnell is never going to go along. You're never going to get those votes. Just ram it through, on the narrowest partisan margins. Biden himself seems committed to at least continuing to try. So what is your sense, given his election, given his popularity and the basis of his support, how important is it for him to get a bipartisan win on, say, infrastructure?
I guess it's a situation where the course of how you get to eventual legislation, if it is passed, even if it is passed on a party line, or if something were to happen to the filibuster, which seems pretty unlikely, but nonetheless, I think Biden wants to appear as bipartisan as possible. And maybe he doesn't actually believe a bipartisan outcome will eventually happen, but I think he wants to take pains to appear bipartisan. And I think in some ways that's worked out for him, because that Morning Consult Politico poll also found that Biden was viewed as the person who most sincerely wants bipartisanship in Washington when they tested him against just like the Democratic or Republican parties as a whole, other leaders in Congress from both parties. So voters do view Biden as maybe the most interested party in terms of actually getting bipartisanship of major figures on the Hill, so and in DC as a whole. So I do think that that's important when you think about his campaign in 2020. You know, he talked about a lot about unity, working with the other side. Like, yes, if I get elected, I can work with Republicans. I think it's this interesting thing where I don't know if voters actually care about bipartisan policy outcomes, but they may care about hearing about it and having politicians who act in certain ways that appear to be appealing to bipartisan sentiment.
I think that's it.
They want bipartisanship. Yeah.
I think that's exactly right. And that's that sort of, you know, split screen there, what they say and what they really want. But I do think it's important to go through the motions. Like, for example, these negotiations between the Biden White House and Senator Capito of West Virginia have broken down, but Biden immediately turned to Senator Cassidy from Louisiana to try to broker a different kind of a deal. And the smartest analysis I've seen is that it's very important for him to continue these talks with Republicans because of he wants to appear that he's doing it to people like Sinema and Joe Manchin, so that they you know, for them, it's to get their votes. You have to have some Republicans. By the way, did that sound believably convoluted? But again, it's part of that get caught trying, whatever the final result is, so that you may end up passing this thing on a very narrow margin, but you have to go through at least the kabuki dance of looking like you're doing it in a bipartisan way. Is that correct?
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly it. And, you know, another little finding from that Morning Consult Politico poll that I think references this is that 75% of voters said that they respected politicians more when they made efforts to get bipartisan support. And basically, Democratic respondents and Republican respondents answered almost exactly the same overwhelming preference for this, and that they respected it more. So, yes, even if you're just doing a dance, it has some importance in terms of how I think voters, Americans as a whole, perceive you.
The problem, of course, though, is that, you know, from the Biden White House point of view, is he's got to keep looking over his shoulder at progressives in the House, so that even though the dynamics in the Senate, would suggest that there is some sort of a centrist compromise, he's got to be able to hold his support in the House as well. And it is interesting at the moment, the kind of the whipsawing. He's been very successful in keeping everybody in line. He has to, because they have no margin. But what is your sense that if Joe Biden comes out tomorrow or next week and says, okay, I have come up with a $1 trillion infrastructure package that will get some Republican support, maybe he'll get 5 to 7 Republican votes for it, or maybe 4 or 5, whatever. But $1 trillion, will the progressives think that he's caved in, that he's sold out, even though that may be the only way to get the package through? What do you think?
I think it's possible that you could have, you know, some sort of rejection on the left. But at the same time, it's one of the things where I wonder with infrastructure, you know, if we were talking about the COVID relief bill and there had been, I don't know, maybe, I guess it's just, I'm trying to think about, like, clearly, Americans have answered in polls that they are supportive of more infrastructure right. spending. That's like a real broad, seemingly easy thing right. to find bipartisan consensus on, though it's not been possible to actually do it, apparently. I think it's possible, but I also don't want to underestimate, you know, Nancy Pelosi's wrangling in the House.
Yeah.
She's been a pretty good wrangler over the years. So maybe a couple members end up voting against it and they squeak by. But maybe you also pick up, you know, the Brian Fitzpatricks of the world, the handful of Republicans in the House who might say, oh, I actually might want to vote for this, or like a John Katko or something from New York, you know. I do think it's possible you could see pushback on the left that even reaches the point of people voting against it. But at the same time, I would say that might not cause it to fail in the end.
See, this would be a huge win for Biden. I think even at $1 trillion, because, you know, out here, I'm in Wisconsin, out here in the country, $1 trillion still sounds like a lot of money. It really does. I mean, it's not like, hey, we're throwing peanuts. It's a freaking $1 trillion. And I think standing there in the Rose Garden and signing this would be a big win for Joe Biden, which makes me wonder, whether Republicans or not, the Republican leadership won't just go to the mat to say, you know, screw even pretending to look like we're bipartisan. I mean, Mitch McConnell has obviously decided at some point in his career that he doesn't care about being bipartisan, that that his road to power has nothing to do with it, and that if he has to just simply say no and block everything, then he's going to do it, right? So, I mean, it seems like that the Republicans have made a different calculation, that they don't even have to be to pretend to be bipartisan, or at least people like Mitch McConnell.
You know, part of that may come from the fact that at this point, the Republican Party base is more conservative. You have fewer people who identify as moderates. See, Gallup does this polling like every year. They check in to see how people self-identify ideologically. The Democratic Party is actually has a majority of people who identify as moderate, and then a large chunk obviously identify as liberal. And then the Republican Party is much more conservative with fewer moderates. And so also this shows up in polling of bipartisanship. You do end up with slightly more Democrats saying that they do favor bipartisanship, that they want. For instance, Pew Research found right before Biden took office that more Democrats were sort of like, Biden, if he can make progress in doing stuff with Republicans, he should do it. And more Republicans were like, the Republican leadership in Congress should not do that with Biden, you know, the inverse. Yeah. So I think it also comes down to a little bit about the parties and their makeup, who their constituents are, who they're appealing to.
So let's talk about Joe Biden right now. You're the poll guy here. Could you explain to me where his approval rating sits right now? Because I have seen it all over the map. Give me your best sense of what his approval rating looks like.
Sure. Well, you know, my organization, 538, we have an approval rating tracker for Biden, and currently he sits at 53% in our average. That has basically not changed since he took office. It's blipped. It's gone a little bit up. It's gone a little bit down, but it's hovered basically between like 52 and 55%, give or take a little. And I think if you took out just a bit of the noise there, it would be a flat line. Mm-hmm. And I think that's indicative of a political environment that hasn't actually changed that much since the 2020 election, in the sense that people are very much in their camps. They're not moving around. So far, at least, Biden hasn't lost support from the coalition that elected him. At the same time, he hasn't won over people who didn't vote for him in the first place, or at least if there's been trade-offs there, it's equaled out.
No, I think you're right here, but then how do you explain the polls that are getting a lot of traction, particularly in you know, progressive media, showing him that at a 60% approval? I mean, I've seen this, that Harvard-Harris survey. I think the Morning Consult poll has him about 60, but you think it's 50. That seems like a big gap.
It does. It's interesting so far. We have a number of polls that are sort of at odds with one another. Now, there are some methodological differences in how things are calculated for some of those polls. Some of them just actually only have two outcomes. People either approve or don't approve, or disapprove, I should say. Or in some other polls, people can say they don't know. And you end up with, you know, 53% saying they approve, 40% disapprove, and then the other 7% say they're not sure, they don't know. So we try to sort of model those responses, knowing that there are different methodologies, and come up with this average. But yeah, I agree that you do have sort of an interesting split in terms of the polls that we're seeing. So I'm honestly not sure yet. And I think it's going to take a little more time to see how things work out.
I think it is that weird situation where I think people are still in the kind of the Trumpian hangover, and they're just sort of glad that Trump's gone, but I don't know how it sorts out. So I don't know if you want to talk about Kamala Harris. She had a terrible day yesterday, and I know I'll get some blowback on this, but it starts off with her on the Today Show, where she had kind of a bad exchange with Lester Holt, and I don't think it got any better with her presser in Mexico City. Let me just play for you a little bit of the back and forth where Lester Holt is pushing back on her on whether or not she has visited the border. Here's Lester Holt and Kamala Harris.
We've been to the border. So this whole thing about the border, we've been to the border. We've been to the border.
You haven't been to the border.
I haven't been to Europe. And I don't understand the point that you're making.
Jeffrey, that just wasn't very good. Your thoughts about it, because she kind of reminded a lot of folks yesterday why her presidential campaign crashed and burned. I don't know what there's a larger significance about how the vice president's doing, but that wasn't a good day for her, was it?
Right. I mean, I think the headlines were generally negative. The coverage of her was generally negative, sort of across the board. And that's not what you want if you're the vice president and you're someone thinking about running for president, potentially either in 2024 or further down the road.
When the president himself is 100 years old, the significance of being vice president is a little bit magnified for her being Joe Biden. Obviously, he's not 100 years old. I know that. Okay, I'm just exaggerating. But the point, especially if he's looking at a second term, people want to at least feel comfortable. Okay, she would be able to step in there. And if anything, I think she just has not found her rhythm yet. And I wonder whether that at some point that becomes a problem for Joe Biden.
I guess it could potentially. Vice presidents who've struggled. The first name that pops into my head is a very different vice president. But Dan Quayle was honestly a bit of an anchor on George H.W. Bush. I'm not really sure how much it mattered at the end of the day for his mm-hmm. political success and failure. And I'm not sure that Harris actually matters that much for the political success or failure of Biden. But at the same time, if you're dealing with, someone misspelling potato or whatever, it can become a distraction.
It can become a distraction. And I think that's the best word. Okay, maybe you could explain something else to me. I'm switching gears here now, because I'm watching, and I don't want to spend a huge amount of time on this, but I'm watching the New York City mayor's race and trying to figure out who's ahead, who's behind. And they have ranked choice voting in this primary, ranked choice voting. What does that – now, this is really wonky now. What does ranked choice voting mean from a polling point of view? Because I've seen a lot of people say you just can't tell who's leading, who's not leading. The polls really don't reflect what's happening because of the ranked choice voting. So there's been a lot of moving around. Andrew Yang was ahead for a while, and now he's not. What is your take on that? What is the interaction between ranked choice voting and our ability to actually poll a race like New York?
I think in theory, it shouldn't change things that much for a pollster if they're going through the full process with respondents of, who's your second choice? Who's your third choice? Who's your fourth choice? Do you have a fourth choice? That kind of thing. And then going through and figuring out the calculations there and how it would work out. So I think in theory, it's not as much of a problem. However, I will say that there are complications there. A lot of pollsters haven't had to do ranked choice voting polling before. So that's a consideration. It does create a longer poll when you're asking respondents, which could lead to more respondents dropping out. And at the same time, I think the other thing is that knowing second, third, fourth, fifth kind of choices is that those can fluctuate, especially in a primary. I mean, primaries are already more volatile to begin with, because in theory, a Democrat is going to like most of the Democrats to some extent. Maybe they dislike one more than the other, but maybe there are a few that they sort of have mixed feelings about. And maybe, when they're talking to the pollster, they rank one second. But then when they get to the polls on election day, they decide to pick somebody else's second who from kind of a middle of the candidate group. So I think that's a challenge, and that actually has more to do with just the way primaries work than necessarily the ranked choice voting part. Or maybe because it's ranked choice voting, that problem of that volatility actually gets magnified a little because you have to figure out how people actually rank things.
Yeah, I think this is just uncharted territory, even thinking about whether people, there's gamesmanship, strategy, all sorts of things. Is ranked choice voting, do you think, is it an effective response or cure for the kind of polarization that we've seen in the primaries? I know you've had a discussion about, is the primary system broken? What do you think? I mean, there are a lot of people who are looking around like, what is it going to be? Will it take to break this tribalization? And ranked choice voting, seems to be coming up with increased frequency. What do you think?
I do think that there's reason to believe that ranked choice voting can reduce negative campaigning. I think there is some evidence for that because, you know, just slamming your opponent could actually lead people to dislike you. I mean, we know that the moment someone goes negative, yes, they might end up hurting the candidate they're going negative on, but they can also end up looking bad. And people sometimes react negatively to candidates going negative. So that lies out there as a potential benefit, and maybe you reduce the sort of the negative tenor of things. And I think in a general election context, that's actually where that could be more important. If you have ranked choice voting and the two candidates, you know, Republican, Democrat, they want to go after each other, but they have to be careful about how they go about after each other, because maybe there are a few voters in the middle who will get turned off from one of the candidates if they go too negative or if they attack a particular thing. So I think that's a potential benefit of maybe lowering the temperature. But I also don't think necessarily that ranked choice voting is going to be a cure for all our ills. I do think that an interesting thing going on is in Alaska, where they're going to be doing this top four primary. So you don't really have party primaries anymore.
Yeah.
Because of that, you know, like Lisa Murkowski and another Republican could advance to the general election, but because of ranked choice voting, they're not going to actually be spoilers for each other. They instead, you know, one might end up winning because they just have broader support across the entire electorate at the end of the day. So that actually is going to be fascinating to me. And we don't really have, you know, that's just a different way of doing it. And I'm very fascinated, just really interested to see how that pans out, because that is different from sort of that straight party primary aspect.
No, that's going to be extremely interesting. And this could have pretty significant effect if in fact you could get legislatures to adopt it. So what are you watching this week? What are you working on right now? What's on your mind? What's your next big question?
Well, actually, I'm in the process of editing a piece on approval ratings. I've been doing a lot of work on that since right around the time Biden took office. And the thing I'm looking at is actually strong approval, strong disapproval. So I just wanted to see about patterns in sort of the intensity of dislike in particular from the opposition party. So in this case, Republicans, Democrats for Donald Trump, Republicans for Barack Obama, and Democrats for George W. Bush. I actually went back to George W. Bush when looking at this and looking at sort of the first 6 months of their time in office, which has traditionally been known as the honeymoon period. It's a period where, you know, maybe you get a little crossover support. Maybe, you know, you saw more Republicans approving of Obama during that time period, more Democrats approving of Bush. But that has gone away to some extent with Trump and to some extent also Biden. And so just looking at sort of the intensity of disapproval and how that reflects the idea that if you're a Republican, you just sort of de facto will not like a Democrat no matter what.
Right.
And vice versa. You know, Democrats not going to like a Republican no matter what. And you're not even going to give them a chance at the outset of their presidency, thus sort of ending what we've known about the honeymoon period, or at least much, you know, reducing it significantly. So that's sort of what I'm looking at.
So, okay, this is interesting to me because I'm trying to think back to the first month of the George H.W. Bush presidency. It seems like a completely different era. You know, really strong likes and dislikes weren't as strong back then, were they? I mean, it wasn't quite as intense. I just don't remember anyone being passionately pro George H.W. Bush. People may have disliked him, but he wasn't the kind of guy that's inspired the kinds of passions that we now – that are now routine. Am I wrong about that? Is this a nostalgic memory, or were things a little bit, you know, more easygoing back then?
I do think, to be frank, I did not look at data before George W. Bush, so I can't say with 100% certainty about what Clinton or George H.W. Bush had. But I will say that the pattern from George W. Bush to Biden has been more and more strong disapproval among people from the other party. So so there's been a rise in those numbers, a more intense dislike. So I would guess, and I would hypothesize that that was probably the case with Bush Senior as well.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Just, you mentioned George W. and I went to George H.W. I was just trying to, you know, go back. So Jeffrey Skelly is an elections analyst for 538 and an alum of the Center for Politics. You're big in, you know, if you want to know anything about Virginia politics, you would be the guy, and you can find Jeffrey Skelly's work at 538.com. Jeffrey, thank you so much for joining me the morning after these two big primaries.
Hey, well, thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And thank you all for listening to today's Bulwark Podcast. I'm Charlie Sykes. We will be back tomorrow, and we'll do this all over again.